who now once again resides here in Berkeley, originally met Baba in 1962 at the East-West Gathering, and he spent 4 days with Baba, as did all of the people who were there at that time. He's had a number of experiences since then that he's going to tell us about. And to tell you a little about him, Gary has been a professional educational consultant. He's taught in public high schools, mainly in and around the South. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina is where he's most recently from, the high school there. Right now, his profession is as a self-employed astrological counselor practicing here in Berkeley. And with that as an introduction, I'll let Gary tell us about the rest of his life and go on into his story. And afterwards, we'll have some questions. Feel free to ask any questions that may occur to you during his talk. Gary? Can I just...
There's a little water here. Sorry, Bob. I've given this talk several times, and always off the top of my head, but for a variety of purposes, none of which I understand, I decided to become literary this evening. So I wrote out one page as perhaps a prologue to my Baba story. By the way, Rogers, I think, has given you the impression that I'm going to be telling you about my life mostly after I met Meher Baba. Most of that's been a disaster. I'd rather not go into a great deal of that. Anyway, this is what I scratched out this afternoon. And for better or for worse, I'd like to share it with you. What follows is my Baba story. I like to think that it's a story of an imaginary trip from God, within God, sometimes without God, though I know intellectually that's just an ego hang-up, and finally to God, Avatar Meher Baba. Despite the words I will use to tell the story, I'm very aware these days of what I would like to call an historical epistemological problem. Is that for head trip? Inherent in the story, and perhaps in all stories. Mine is a highly personal story, thus an autobiographical one, and to a great extent semi-fictitious. Fictitious in that there will be necessarily many omissions, some conscious, out of a sense of propriety and appropriateness, and many unconscious omissions as well. Two, and importantly, I have forgotten what I was thinking about during the happenings and events I will relate to you. It seems that those thoughts, as well, are part of the fabric of the tapestry of my tale. Thus, I can only tell a small part of my story. And as I have changed during the years, so has my story changed. Nevertheless, I would like to dedicate the story to his great silence, which is, in the final analysis, the only story worth listening to. And I might add, the only one that will never change, as well as the only one that has any semblance of truth and reality. So much for literary efforts. The theme of the story is the same as when I told it before. Theme being what's happening, what's going on. I wish someone would tell me. I certainly don't know. I suppose the purpose of the story is to illustrate, hopefully, that Meher Baba is always using us, whether we know it or not, consciously or unconsciously, and that he's constantly with us and within us and guiding us, I think, probably every second of our lives. Come in. Every story has to have a beginning point, so I'll begin mine at my age 12. prior to being 12 years old, which was a couple years ago, I did have in my earliest years a sense of a separation and aloneness. I don't think I need to dwell on that, but that is one childhood memory of mine. My father was a career Navy man. We moved about quite a bit. Finally, he was stationed in Atlanta, Georgia, the Naval ROTC at Georgia Tech. And for some reason, he and my mother decided that it would be wise to get back in the church. They had really had enough of the Navy scene. If you people have been in the military, I think you know what I'm alluding to. So we started attending church regularly, and it was very soon after that that I felt within the structure of the church and within the meetings in the church, what I would say, a great reaching out toward God, maybe God in the abstract, but I felt something very deeply. And throughout my high school years, I found myself very involved in Sunday school, training union, prayer meetings, and really almost involved as much in church as any other kind of thing, high school sports and so forth. So there, I came out of, I would say, a middle-class Protestant background, similar to maybe many of the backgrounds of the people in here. Nothing special, but there was that religious dimension. Very involved in it just prior to going to college. It's my observation that most people who go through some kind of religious crisis in our culture, that this crisis occurs after they go to college. This was not the case with me. About 3 weeks before I was to go off to college, I read a book that had a profound influence on me. It made me really start to think. And then I woke up one morning. I literally woke up. And I was laying in bed thinking, and all of a sudden it occurred to me that all this business about going to church was absolutely stupid and insane. And that the church, at least the Protestant church or the Baptist church that I was going to, was empty and devoid of anything that had any meaning. And I didn't understand why I hadn't figured that out before. I immediately stopped going. And, of course, you can imagine the reaction of my parents and the rest of the people in the community. I just quit. Just like that. 3 weeks later, I started to college in Atlanta, Oglethorpe University, which some of you may be familiar with. And soon after college, entering college, I was metaphorically turned upside down on top of my head. Came into contact with ideas and people that I didn't understand. Everybody thought they had the answer to this and that. And people talking about God and all different kinds of religions and all different kinds of philosophy and history and psychology and philosophy. I was very confused. And this period of confusion, I would say, lasted until this moment. I have to take this water, not because my mouth is dry, but I'm a chain smoker. So
change your heart.
Thank you, Roger. Soon after I entered college, I would say that there was an underlying motif of depression and despair. I had, I would say, many of the similar experiences that many of you and other people have when they go to college. The things that were most important in my mind were passing the tests with as little study as possible, playing as much poker as I possibly could get in the evenings, after all afternoons of tennis, And of course, there were women and booze and et cetera, et cetera. Never any drugs. This was before the drug scene. There were a number of influences in college, as I look back, that had an effect on me and an influence on me that seems to be part of the fabric of the movement toward Baba. One in particular was a music professor that I had, who was probably the most educated individual I have ever run into in my entire life, perhaps with the exception of James Terry Deuce, who I met back in the early 60s. This man was, to give you an example, he was a Nietzschean and had read all of Friedrich Nietzsche in the original German by the time he was 16 years old, and had an original copy of Nietzsche's Will to Power in his safety deposit vault, and he had lost multi-$1 million in the stock market crash. And, the reason I'm bringing him up is I recall stating to him very strongly that there was no way that I could ever possibly get interested in anything that would have to do with metaphysics. And he told me, he said, never make such an absolute statement. You don't know what's going to happen. Also, I had one roommate in college that made quite an impression on me. A young man from Lima, Peru, who had spent 6 years in a Jesuit school in Lima, highly trained, very articulate, very scholarly. So he spent all of his time in college hanging around with the athletes, because the professors and the students at the school, he couldn't relate to them intellectually. But I recall one evening, we were in a very late one evening, we were in a very heated argument about religion. And I blurted out that I could not understand or accept any sort of God that would condemn someone to an eternal hell. That constitutionally I was not prepared to deal, cope, or entertain that such an idea could exist. And he was very angry is not the right word. He was very put out with me. And finally, he calmed down after this argument, and he looked at me, and he said, Garrett, you're going to find God because you're looking too hard for it. And then at the end of my third year of college, I ran into one other gentleman that I'd like to share with you. His name was Bill Saunders. And the reason I ran into him, I had no plans for a summer job. And Bill had been a student at Georgia Tech, and in his third year had quit school, and he had gone to Europe, spent a couple years in Europe, and learned a few languages. Then he went and he bought himself a bicycle and started pedaling east. Ended up selling the bicycle in Pakistan. And for 7 years, literally became a fakir. He had come back to finish school, become a doctor. And his idea when I met him was that he wanted to go down to his father's farm in Alabama and pick some vegetables and come up and sell the vegetables on the street in Atlanta. And he just needed somebody to help him. So, and he asked me, and I said, sure. Now, I didn't know that he had had this kind of experience. But I was able to spend about 3 days with him, driving down to southern Alabama and driving back. And he'd drive at about 35 miles an hour. And I said, why don't you go faster? And he said, what's the hurry? And he was the kind of individual, he had an apartment that he studied at, and there was nothing in the apartment. He could lay down, just sleep on the floor. And he'd go to sleep anytime he wanted to. And he had beautiful, very pastoral dreams. he ate very little. And there was always this nice smile on his face. And I can remember seeing him sit in a rocking chair in this big front porch in these old southern homes out in the country for 3 hours just smelling a flower. talking about Einstein, the theory of relativity, and then just being quiet. Well, this person made a very profound effect upon me because obviously he had something that I didn't have. I still don't have it. But something that I wanted. Something that I recognized as being worthwhile. One of the reasons I could recognize it is because it tied in with some of the reading that I'd been doing at the time, which I made a list of a few things that I remember. One book that made a big impact on me at some point during college was Martin Buber's I and Thou. And I'm sure many of you have read Zen Buddhism, particularly D.T. Suzuki's work. Walt Whitman. And in particular, because it's a very romantic novel, I like romance. And some of my friends read a lot of romance. The Somerset Maugham's The Razor's Edge, which had a big influence on me. So in any event, I only spent 3 or 4 days with him. His father was not there. There were no fruits. There were no vegetables. The project did not materialize. But to show you what incredible faith this man had, he only had one old Studebaker truck, $10 in his pocket, and he was absolutely convinced that he was going to be going to school in Augusta, Georgia, the following fall, to study medicine, become a doctor, to help people, get married, and have 12 children. This was his ambition. And he wasn't worried about it at all. If I've ever met anyone outside of some select Baba lovers that actually live, don't worry, be happy, it certainly was this man. So I got to the point of beginning my fourth year of college. And I thought that I was in a pretty good place. I thought I had things under control. And I certainly thought I was going to finish college and then we'd see what would happen after that. But that wasn't going to be the case. Thank you. Money had run out. Scholarship funds had run out. They had run out because I had taken all WFs the previous spring because I couldn't complete my courses because I'd been playing too much tennis and too much poker. So there was no money. So I couldn't afford to live on campus. So I was living about a mile off campus in the evenings in an animal hospital. The purpose was just to stay there in the evenings in case there was a call or someone had an emergency. It was a rather unpleasant experience because I was up half the night listening to dogs and cats howling and screeching and carrying on. And, of course, there were various vapors in the air. It wasn't a very pleasant place to live. In any event, one evening, some things happened. Which it's not necessary to go into, but the effect upon them was to plunge me into, be quiet, you know, to plunge me, and I'm really not trying to be theatrical here, but to plunge me into an incredible depression and despair. The only way I can describe it is, musically it would correspond to perhaps a Mahler symphony. But much heavier, and I entertained thoughts of suicide. But I thought, well, the best thing I can do is just go to bed, and perhaps I can go to sleep, and tomorrow's another day. So I did that, and all I can remember. The lights were out, but I can remember being surrounded by this incredible blackness. And I was laying in bed, and I had a sense of a void inside of me, an incredible emptiness. And laying there, I felt a physical sensation way down here in my stomach. And I felt it move and come up. And I said out loud, "God help me." And I recall pushing myself up a little bit in bed and actually saying out loud, "Now, why did I say that?" I had not prayed in years. I had called myself either an agnostic or an atheist. But it just came out. This was like something that I had no control over. I didn't consciously do it. In any event, I went to school the next day. The day passed without... I remember one thing that happened that day is I was sitting on the steps of the library and some young lady that I had was a friend of mine in the previous spring and had some sort of springtime romance with her. This turned to me and said, "Why don't you get out of here for the salvation of your soul?" So later that afternoon, I went to back to the animal hospital, and I looked out into the west, and there was this very beautiful sunset. And I thought, "I'm getting out of here. And I'm going to get out of here fast. I've had it up to here with college, with the people that I'm with. I'm just not comfortable with it, and I'm going to leave." And I made that decision to do that. And within 10 days, I was gone. All of the professors that I had in college, who I was quite friendly with, were opposed to it. Of course, my parents were opposed to it. It literally freaked them out. This was before the days of the, quote, and I do not like this word, but the hippies and hitchhiking and so forth. But within 10 days, I had quit school. I got my mother to drive me to the other side of the Chattahoochee River, which is a rather cruel thing to do to her. I did a very Aries thing. I didn't think about what I was doing. I just headed out. $50 in my pocket, one small suitcase, an umbrella in case it rained, and a sign.
Excuse me? You were a real hippie, weren't you?
I didn't even know it. And a sign that said Atlanta to San Francisco. I had one friend that I had gone to high school with who was studying psychology, taking his doctorate at the University of California here in Berkeley. And I thought, well, I'll go out and visit him, and maybe I can get a job. Or if that doesn't work out, I'll go in the service, but I just want to get away. So off I went, cross country. Well, I don't need to go into the details of the story hitchhiking cross country because it was rather uneventful. To summarize it, I made it across country in less time than it takes the Greyhound bus. I was wined and dined all the way across. At one point, I was dropped off by a traveling salesman in Kansas. He picked me up about 8 o'clock in the morning, hit a six-pack of beer. You know, in his car and his big six, what is it, 10-gallon hat, 6-gallon hat? Well, one of these big cowboy hats. And he stopped in Prague, Kansas. And I got out of the car and I said, "My God, I'm going to be stuck here the rest of my life. This is nowhere land." Within 10 minutes, I got a ride from an insurance salesman all the way to Long Beach, California, just like that. Well, the bottom line is that I got to San Francisco on Halloween night, October 1961, and all my clothes were cleaned. I'd been well fed, as I said, all the way across. I'd spent less than $16. It was an ideal trip. Nothing had happened. My friend met me. We went out and... spent some time in San Francisco, went home, went to bed, and and that was my arrival. The next day he was off to school, and I woke up and I was alone in the apartment. Now, how many of you know where Kezar Stadium is? Okay. Next to Golden Gate Park. That's where I was living. About 9:30 in the morning, after I'd had a little breakfast, I thought, let me say that I had no thought about livelihood, no thought about the fact that I was subject to the draft, no thought about getting back to school. I just looked out the window and I said, what a beautiful day. And it wasn't raining. Yeah. And I think I'll take a walk and find out something about this town. I just get this very poetic idea. So I started walking. And I walked. I walked for, I've never clocked it, but I would imagine it's about 10 miles. All the way from the corner of the Golden Gate Park to the top of Knob Hill. Up those very steep hills. Later, under hypnosis, I found out that I was going on up one of the hills, one of the steepest hills, and I had this incredible longing, incredible desire. I was very tired to get to the top of the hill. I almost stopped, but there's something in me said, I have to get to the top of this hill. So finally I did, and I stopped at the corner of Powell and California Street, across the street from the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And I paused there for a second, and I guess to illustrate how one thought can possibly change one's destiny, I thought, well, I better turn around and go back. I'm tired, and it's a long walk back, and I don't have money for public transportation, or I don't want to spend the money. But there was this nice park up there. So I thought, I'll just walk around this little park and then I'll come home. So I started walking down Powell Street in front of the Fairmount Hotel. And I got within about 25, 30, 35 feet from the corner. And I noticed this lady about to cross the street. And she dropped a package. And I just motioned to her like this. Wait a minute, lady. Wait a minute, I'll pick up your package. And she looked at me, gave me this very quizzical look. And she allowed me to pick up the package. And somehow we started talking. And I think we talked for about a half an hour, standing there on the corner. She was a very gracious person. She pointed out, first thing she pointed out was Alcatraz, which you could see in the distance. And she told me where Chinatown was. And then she started kind of probing a little bit and asking about my situation. And she seemed to be disturbed because I was out of school, subject to the draft. money running low, et cetera, et cetera. And so she said, come with me. So she invited me into the foyer of her apartment building, the Park Lane Apartments, and she went upstairs. And I remember very vividly standing in the foyer, and I looked into a little courtyard, and there was a statue of a Buddha. And the feeling of deja vu passed. It was very clear. I felt like I'd been there before. The person that dropped the package, it's obviously going to come out at some point in the story, some of you already know.
Don't.
Let him suffer. I love you. She came down and let's do a play together. She came downstairs and she gave me a telephone number of someone to call for the possibility of a job. His name is Alan Yule. And the address of the California State Employment Agency. So I left. She said, call me in a few days, let me know how things are going. So I went back home, and later in the afternoon, my friend came back. Now, here's the really incredible part of this happening. He asked me what I'd done during the day. Now, if you just think for a minute, at least at that time, in the entire Bay Area, there must be at least, 3 million people, 4 million. I said, well, I met this lady today. Her name is Mrs. Deuce. And she's sort of taken an interest in you know, what's going on with me. He said, Mrs. Deuce? He knew of her. He knew of her. Through her hairdresser. And he said, she follows some holy man in India. And when he said that, the only metaphor that I can use is that my mind started going like a computer. Just, and I thought, what is going on? What is happening? Would somebody please tell me? in any event, that was my first meeting with Murshida Ivy Deuce. You know, there's some things in my story I usually don't tell. Some of them are very personal, but I think I'll share one with you. In the spirit of Phyllis Frederick being very open and sharing a lot of things that she used to didn't share. I later found out that Murshida had been my mother at least 10 times. And my brother once. And even this last time that I was out here, I was leaving Ben and Neela's one afternoon after watching part of the Super Bowl and losing some money over there. And I had not seen Murshida since I'd been out here. And I only got 200 yards away from Ben and Neela's, and this, you know, it opened up and tears started flowing. It's a very close connection there, and I'm very grateful to her for it. In any event, several days went by, and I did call her, and I thought I'd be very clever. So I consciously, in the telephone conversation, I consciously manipulated the subject of the conversation around to the subject of mysticism.
Well, that was clever of you.
I hope one thing you get from this story is that, and it's beginning to dawn on me. It's dawned on me intellectually, but I haven't fully experienced it yet. It's these things that go on in our minds, and these decisions we make, and these things that we think we're doing. I don't think we're doing it all. I think God is doing it. I'm going to say something about that a little bit later. In any event, she said, are you interested in that? And I said, yes. And she talked about an oriental rug, and she said that life was very much like an oriental rug. It had a pattern. And, you know, and she said, perhaps we'll have to get together and have a chat. Said my husband is going to be out of town soon, and you can come up, and I'll have some time, and we'll visit and talk. So I think a week passed, and a meeting was arranged. And I can recall taking the cable car up to Knob Hill and thinking in my mind, what am I doing? Where am I going? What's happening? And I thought, well, I'll just be a gracious receiver. So I went up the elevator and rang the doorbell, and her Chinese cook had gone for the day, so she answered the door herself, invited me in, and I turned to my right, and I saw my first picture of Obama. And immediately, I had a sense of being at home. And We talked from 7 o'clock until 11 o'clock that night. And, of course, she told me a great deal about Mirabala. And even though I, like all of you, have my own types of resistances toward growth and letting go and surrendering, I wish I'd heard the talk next week before I get... there was no question in my mind that Baba was obviously God. It just clicked like that. She asked me all kinds of questions. Do you see things? Do you see colors? Do you see visions? This and this and this and this. No. Nothing special. She asked me, what's your birthday? I said, what do you want to know that for? It's my first contact with astrology. I didn't know what astrology was. She wanted to do my chart, so I gave her my birth data. And about a week or 10 days later, I think it was a week later, I was with her, and she had done the chart, and she said just a few things. But one thing stands out in my mind. She said, looking at the chart, she said, there's something in here that indicates that exactly 1 year from the day that you met me, something's going to happen to change the entire course of your life. You'll never be the same again. I met her on November 1st, 1961, and I met Meher Baba on October 31st, 1962. And if you remember, there's a change in the day because of the international date line. She hit the nail right on the head. I mean, right on. Question? Oh, you want to turn it over? I don't know how to operate this thing. Come on. You're the expert, not me.